So for the last several weeks, we've been focusing on the five hindrances. And the five hindrances are sensual desire, ill will, anger, ill will, sloth and torpor, and restlessness and agitation, and then skepticism and doubt. And these are obstacles that we encounter in the meditative process. We began the series discussing sensual desire, and for the last 3 or 4 weeks, we've been talking about ill will or aversion. Last week, we were talking about pain, physical pain. Physical pain as an aversive state that we encounter not only in meditation, but also in our lives. So we actually spent, I believe, about 3 weeks just talking about physical pain. So last week we were doing physical pain. Now this week we're sort of segueing into emotional pain. And to a certain degree, this whole subject constitutes really the core essence of the teaching, in the sense that emotional pain, or what we regard as suffering, is really the bane of our human existence. And so the entire teaching of the Buddha, the entire teaching of the Dharma, and I think the entire purpose for which most of us pursue what we regard to be the spiritual practice, is about coming to terms with suffering in our lives. So this is a very important subject, and I'm anticipating spending maybe 1 or 2 or maybe 3 weeks sort of kind of unpacking, you know, the whole subject. I'd like to kind of begin with an observation. I was listening to a podcast this past week. Krista Tippett on Being was interviewing a Dutch psychiatrist by the name of Bessel van der Kolk. Bessel van der Kolk. And he's a specialist on trauma. You know, trauma. So physical trauma, emotional trauma. And I felt this was a powerful way of beginning to understand emotional suffering or emotional pain. Because for a lot of what we experience as emotional pain, it's based on some form of trauma. And one of the things that we're beginning to understand in our contemporary understanding of, you know, emotional intelligence is that trauma, what we understand as trauma, is not necessarily all, you know, just like being in a car crash or PTSD because you're in a, you know, you're in a firefight in Iraq, or, you know, you're in an earthquake or a landslide. Emotional traumas can happen in many other ways, much more subtle ways. It could obviously could happen in terms of violence, if you've been beaten up, or if you've been raped, or if you've been sexually abused, or it could be triggered if you're, you know, just insulted, or you feel some strong form of reactive emotion to your experience in some form or other. So we've come to understand trauma in a much more, I think, generalized way in terms of how we experience trauma in our lives. And you don't necessarily have to be in an earthquake or a flood or a car accident. This can happen to any one of us, you know, in the daily course of our existence as we grow up as children in our families. Anyway, so what van der Kolk was discussing, and I'm kind of paraphrasing, so I couldn't remember exactly, but basically this is my understanding of what he was saying, is that when we experience traumas, these traumas become embedded in our bodies. Having a trauma is a physical experience. It's not a mental experience, it's a physical experience. And the terminology for this, interestingly, was actually developed by Charles Darwin. When Charles Darwin wrote apparently a groundbreaking work on trauma. And how he describes it is that it's any kind of experience that is heartbreaking, gut-wrenching, or where you feel a sense of shock, a sense of strong emotional reactivity to the experience. It could be shock, surprise, embarrassment, or obviously humiliation, things like that. Or it could be, you know, some gut-wrenching, you know, surprise or downturn in your experience. Heartbreaking, you know, it could be the breaking of an emotional relationship, the death of a loved one. These are all traumas. These are things we experience. And when we say experience, what I'm saying is it's something that we feel in the body. It's not something that you conceptually come to understand. It's something that you feel. So as you feel it, because you're feeling it, it's a physical process, right? I mean, it's so simple that we don't really stop to absorb, you know, what the meaning of that really is. Because when you're experiencing some kind of trauma, as subtle or as, you know, simple as it might be, you're experiencing it in your body. It's a physical experience. And so it gets programmed into our brains and into our physical muscle in ways that sometimes are not accessible to our conscious minds. Now, this is a very key part. And what he was basically saying is that, you know, our makeup, if you will, our mental makeup is comprised of what our, you know, in terms of our brain, our conscious intelligence is, our so-called reptilian aspects of our brain, the amygdala, you know, the parts of us that control our emotional and fight or flight, you know, bare survival, autonomic systems, and then the more rational, intelligent, conscious, you know, prefrontal cortex aspects of our brain. So there's the rational, conscious, you know, verbal aspect, and then there's the emotional, deep-seated sort of reptilian parts of our brain. Now, the thing that neurologists are beginning to understand is that these two aspects of our brain are not that well connected. They're connected, but they're not that well connected. So that they're parts of our reptilian experience in terms of these traumatic experiences that we might have experienced that are embedded in the reptilian part of our brain and body and not that accessible to our conscious awareness. So this is how, you know, PTSD or, you know, deep forms of trauma, we can be going through our lives and not even aware that we've experienced these traumas, but then something would trigger it, you know, like a sound or the sight of some visual stimulus, and we could, you know, we could be triggered into a full-blown trauma and not even be aware that this is happening, because all of a sudden this sort of reptilian aspect of our brain just simply takes over and we just relive that experience, completely reliving it, completely unaware that this is what's happening. So the aspect, you know, the thing about the way the trauma arises is that it arises out of this unconscious part of our minds and basically takes over, you know, our entire consciousness for a period of time in which we're, you know, experiencing this traumatic episode. So he was, as a therapist, as a psychiatrist, was using these insights to really look at the shortcomings of so-called talk therapy, you know, where you sit down with a psychologist and you sort of try to talk out your experience, because talking about it, thinking about it, conceptualizing your experience simply does not reach those deeper levels of your brain where these experiences, where these traumas reside. And one of the things he noticed is that, like, for example, is that people who are patients, his patients who are trauma victims, are largely cut off from their bodies. They're not in contact with their bodies at all. They're all in their heads. They're completely in your head all the time, and you're just simply not aware of your body in terms of your feelings, your sensations, your sensitivity to what's going on in your body. And you're constantly kind of looping around, you know, about your experience, but you're not really connecting to what's actually arising in your body, because you're simply cut off, because that rational part of the brain is disconnected from the emotional sort of part of the brain where this pain resides. So for this psychiatrist, the best therapies that he encourages, that he, you know, sort of speaks about, are therapies that bring us into contact with our bodies through ways of accessing our feelings, sensations, physical movement, you know, exercises like Tai Chi, yoga, you know, Qigong, but basically processes that allow us to open to what we feel in our bodies. And, you know, of course, as I'm listening to this, I'm saying, well, this is what mindfulness meditation is. Mindfulness meditation is the process par excellence that is geared to quieting the discursive mind, you know, sort of getting away from all the chatter that's going on conceptually in this rational conscious mind, and moving down into, you know, the texture of our sensate experience, what we're actually experiencing in the body, and allowing that experience of what we feel to begin to reveal these deeper themes of trauma, pain, and suffering that arise from our subconscious when we access it through sensations in our body. So when we talk about emotional pain, when we talk about afflictive emotions, when we talk about suffering, to the extent that these experiences, particularly if they're very deep, particularly if they come from traumatic experiences in our lives, to some extent, basically, number one, define the suffering that we experience in our lives, which is largely, number two, unconscious. This is the important thing. We're actually not conscious of a lot of our suffering, or the place from which our suffering comes, because we're sort of, because of the nature of how this works, you know, in our mental apparatus, in terms of our neurological structure, we don't have access to it through our conscious parts of our brains. So the only way we have access to it is through the sensate experience in the body that arises as a result of kind of opening up to the feeling of what these experiences may be. And this is exactly what we do in meditation. We open up to the feeling of what is there, whether it's an emotion, a sensation, you know, pain, pleasure, whatever we might be feeling in the body, it's opening to the feeling of what is arising. I mean, even when we focus on the breath, it's focusing on the feeling of the breath in the body. It's all about feeling. Those who have done, you know, deeper meditation, have gone to retreats, who are familiar with walking meditation and all the various forms of meditation and mindfulness practice that we do, know that it's all about deepening, refining, and sharpening your capacity to feel sensations in the body. It's all about that, in the sense of, you know, energy, how energy moves in the body. When you go into states of advanced meditation like samadhi, when you go into states of rapture and bliss, and, you know, all the way up the jhanic steps, it's all about having access to the feelings that arise in these higher and higher, more esoteric meditative states. It's all about feeling, what you're actually feeling as you get into these higher meditative states. Also, it's all about feeling when you start to encounter sadness, grief, anger, regret, remorse, rage, boredom, sleepiness, restlessness, agitation. How does it feel in the body? How do you access these emotional states? You access them through the feeling of the state, not the thought. It's not about anger that I'm experiencing, or sadness, or grief, or regret. It's about how it feels in the body. Because that is the doorway. You can name a mental state, but naming a mental state is simply creating a conceptual label that you put onto that mental state. But you're not actually encountering that mental state in your body. So the only way you can encounter that mental state, engage that mental state, is how you are open to the feeling of that mental state in your body. But simply by conceptualizing in your mind, you're creating an abstract metaphor for what you're feeling, but you're not feeling it. So the whole purpose, the whole process of engaging your emotion, you know, whether it's emotional pain or whatever you're engaging, is by feeling the sensate experience of the emotion itself. Not by naming it or talking about it, but by feeling it as it arises in the body. So this is really the key, you know, this is really exciting because this is basically the mindfulness and, you know, the latest sort of psychological, you know, trauma, you know, sort of therapeutic, you know, kind of research basically coming together. And there's a mutual reinforcement of how this practice works in terms of how we access and work with emotional pain. So it's all about how we feel emotional pain. So this is, okay, so think about it. So how do I feel my rage, or how do I feel my anger, or my irritation, or my annoyance, or my jealousy, or my, right? My God, you know, most of us don't even want to think about those things, much less actually feel them. And this is the point. This is the whole point about spiritual liberation. You got to face your suffering. You got to open to your suffering. You got to have the courage. You have to have the courage, basically it's courage, the willingness to face your dark side, to face the parts of you that you just don't want to face because it's embarrassing, it's discouraging, it's demoralizing, it's, you don't want to think of yourself as being jealous or angry or whatever, you know, the things that we, because we have such high images of ourselves. But no, we all carry these dark shadows in our closets. The only question is, how willing are we to be honest about ourselves? How willing are we to look at our dark side, our afflictive emotions, our emotional pain, open to them, really feel them, and allow them to begin to release? This is the whole idea. The whole process of release comes through the doorway of conscious awareness. It only releases when it arises into conscious awareness. It cannot release unless it's brought into the doorway of conscious awareness. Because if we're not aware of it, it's just down there and it stays there because we're simply not aware of it. We're not conscious of it. We've closed the door to our suffering. And we're too afraid to open it. And that's generally what happens to most of us. We run from our emotional pain. We're afraid to face it. So this is the challenge of awakening. This is the challenge of enlightenment, if you want to, that's, you know, it's such a overused word now, but I like the word awakening because it awakens us to what's really going on, you know, in our lives. Now, I'd like to kind of move this, and this is about, you know, Bessel van der Kolk, but and the whole relationship between trauma and mindfulness. Move it to how we experience afflictive emotions in the meditative practice and how we work with it. So in terms of the process of how this works. Now, the first thing, as you're aware, you know, when we do the meditative practice, there are about three or four sort of levels of how we work with our afflictive emotions. So I'll start with the most simple and then go, you know, progressively to the more complex and the deeper levels of you know, sort of release or liberation, if you will. At the most basic level, you know, we all went through, you know, a 45-minute sitting. So we're told to, you know, focus our attention on our breathing. So if a thought or an emotion arises, right, so we note whatever arises, we give it a label, thinking, or if it's particularly powerful emotionally, we could say anger, or sadness, or annoyance, you know, give it a little bit more, you know, a little bit more precise label. And we try to let it go, right? We just let it go. The whole point is not to get hijacked by this thought, right? Just carried away. We don't want to get hijacked by these thoughts. So we note them and we let them go and we bring our attention back to our breath. Now, in that very, very simple but profound act, what we've done is we've noticed that the mind is in a state of agitation or annoyance or sadness, right? We've noticed, we see the mind state that we're in. That's a very powerful, I mean, we don't give that much credit, but just to actually acknowledge what's arising in the mind is a very powerful thing. You know, we see what's going on in the mind. Secondly, we note it. We say anger, or sadness. And we somehow are able to release it and move our attention away from it back to the breath. We're sort of like turning our back on it and saying, okay, not now. I'm not going to get on that train and just get, you know, carried off. I'm going to turn around, walk back into the train station, and come back to my breath. Now that's, when you think about the internal volition that occurs, that act of volition, that act of choosing, I'm not going to get carried away thinking about this or that, you know, I'm going to say not now, I'm going to let it go, and I'm going to bring my attention back to my breath. That's an incredibly powerful act. You're literally beginning to manage what's coming up in your mind. You know, this is, you're now not out of control anymore. You're sort of in control. You're beginning to exercise some degree of control out of what thoughts you choose to let go and what thoughts you choose to stay with. Okay, so this is you're already beginning to develop that degree of objectivity of mind that allows you to begin to work with what's arising in your mind. Just in the simple act of noting something, letting it go, and coming back to your breath. It's that profound. It sounds so simple, but it's actually quite, quite profound. Now, the whole point of the meditative practice, this noting and letting go, you know, process that we're just describing, is part of building what we call concentration. Now, the way concentration is defined in the practice is attaining that mental state where the mind is not just continually distracted by whatever discursive thoughts that are rolling into our minds. In other words, our mind is basically beginning to quiet down and come to a reasonable level of stillness and quietude. So we're not just sitting there chattering away, as we usually do, you know, thinking about stuff all the time. We're trying to get the mind to literally quiet down. Now that quieting process is what we call concentration. It's called coming into concentration, coming into absorption, mental focus, mental absorption. And so this is why this practice at this level is so powerful with regard to, you know, stress management, you know, mindfulness-based stress reduction, because it allows us to confront all the chatter, all the noise that's going on in our mind, noting it, letting it go, noting it, letting it go, noting it, letting it go, and allowing the mind to reach some level of stillness. So we're basically trying to quiet the mind. So we're coming into what is called samadhi. Samadhi is the term for, you know, you've heard quiet mind, still mind, silent mind. This is what it means, a mind that's relatively free. I mean, it's not completely free, but relatively free of this kind of random discursive thinking which goes on all the time in our minds. Now, as we reach this stage, it's not as if the mind is turned off or not functioning. It's just that this surface chatter is gradually quieting down. Now, a wonderful analogy is if you look at the surface of the ocean, you know, on the surface you'll see all kinds of turbulence, waves and foam and people swimming and fish moving and all kinds of activity going on. But if you were to go down, say, 100 feet, all of a sudden, you know, 100 feet is quite a bit. You go down 50 feet, and, you know, it's a little quieter, you know, you can see all the people and the movement in the boats on the surface, but it's a little quieter. But then you go on 100 feet, you know, it gets a little bit less light, a little darker. Then you see, you feel the subtle movements of currents that are moving, but, you know, it's a lot less noise. Then if you go down, say, 500 feet or 1,000 feet, you know, all of a sudden you're in complete darkness. And all the noise is gone, you know, all the superficial movements are gone, and you come into a really deep place of stillness. And then sometimes you start to see these strange creatures that are moving around. You know, I mean, you don't even know what they are, but all of a sudden you realize, my God, there's stuff going on down here. And you go down to the bottom of the Mariana Trench, and then, you know, you start to see things that you never even realized existed. But this, our minds are like this. I mean, our mind is like the ocean. As you go deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper, you get into your subconscious, down into the unconscious levels. And so what we're doing is we're quieting the chatter on the surface so that we have more access to what's deeper, you know, in our subterranean levels of consciousness. And this is where, if there are traumas, if there are experiences that are hidden deep in our subconscious, we start to open to whatever evidence we might have that they're there. And what is that evidence? It's the feelings that begin to arise. The feeling of sadness, the feeling of anger, or the feeling of regret, or remorse, or guilt. How does it feel when it starts to arise in our body? So we start to feel things. We're opening, so in other words, our entire perceptual mechanism is now sort of moving to a deeper level where it's not constantly engaged in conceptual thoughts, rational conceptual discursive thinking, but down to the level of feeling what's arising in the body. Now, if there's any emotional sort of energy that begins to arise, this is where we start to contact that emotional energy. And this is why, for example, particularly in longer retreats, you know, if you're in a retreat for a week or several weeks, you know, within 4 or 5 days, people start to have these emotional experiences because your meditation is settling to the point where you're now past all the surface chatter and you're coming down to the deeper levels of sort of perceptual receptivity, and then you start to encounter your emotional self. at a deeper level. And this is where you begin to perceive this energy that's arising from this deeper level. Now, the other thing about it is that because of the fact that your mind is relatively still, and this is an experience that all experienced meditators report, because your mind is not expending energy thinking about stuff, you know, in terms of discursive thinking, that energy is actually going into the actual perception of experience as it arises in your body. The result is that people have this almost kind of surreal, extrasensory experience of all the six sense doors, like smell, taste, touch, feeling, sensation, thoughts, particularly food. You know, you eat food, you know, and the taste of food somehow is amplified because you're just experiencing it at a different level of perception. In other words, your perceptual capabilities, you're coming into an altered state of consciousness, literally, where you're actually perceiving your experience at a level that you would not ordinarily perceive unless you were in that meditative state. So this is a state that one cultivates when you go into deeper forms of meditation. But the point here is that the way we contact our experience is through the feeling of the experience as it arises in your body. It's the sensate experience, the sensate nature of our experience that we encounter. Of course, the mind will then begin to distinguish. This is anger, this is sadness, this is grief. But the primary point of contact is how it feels in the body. Now, the thing about the whole logic of how this works, and this is, you know, in my mind, almost miraculous, because this is actually in the sutras, the way the Buddha teaches it. If you're experiencing a painful emotion, say anger arises and you're feeling the anger, but the mindfulness is strong and you're seeing the anger, in the moment that you're seeing the anger and you're noting it, and you're saying anger, or you're saying, this is anger, I'm angry, or anger is arising, the moment where you acknowledge the anger, the moment you are aware of the anger is not there. Because you cannot, the brain cannot do two things simultaneously. The brain can only do one thing at a time. Now, it could be a tenth of a second, you know, or you know, even a hundredth of a second. It could be in a nanosecond, you know, things are happening. So it seems like you might be doing two things simultaneously, but actually you're only doing one thing at one time, at one interval of time in your brain. So the moment that you're saying anger, anger, the anger's not there. It'll come back in the next moment, you know, because it doesn't disappear, it comes back. But then if there's another moment of mindfulness, anger, anger, the moment's, you know, the anger's not there, then the energy comes back, then the mindfulness cuts in, then the energy comes back, the mindfulness cuts in. What you're doing is you're interrupting the energy of the anger with these moments of awareness, right? The moments of cognition. So by doing that, you're starting to attenuate the energy of the emotion that you're feeling. So that's why people always say, whenever I practice mindfulness and an emotion arises, it almost disappears. So if your mindfulness is strong and you're observing the emotion, whatever it might be, 9 out of 10 times, if your mindfulness is strong, that emotion will disappear, including pain, physical pain. So, you know, this is the basis of how the mindfulness works. So if you use the mindfulness in a very strong way, you know, it's focused and steady, you know, and emotional pain arises, anger, sadness, grief, regret, remorse, whatever it might be, that in itself, just the awareness itself is enough to attenuate and remove that emotion. So literally, that's a moment of liberation. That's a moment of freedom that comes from the mindfulness. Now the other, so we're going down another level, so this is like the second level, we're going down to a third level. There's another level in which this operates, and that is if you are in the state of, you know, quiet mind, still mind, and you're able to see, you know, with this sort of almost extra cognitive perceptual, you know, capability in terms of what's arising, because you're seeing it with such clarity, the whole experience of seeing these emotions arising has the quality of what I call it an epiphany. It's an epiphany. It's like you see it in a way that you never saw it before. Because usually before, you know, you didn't want to deal with your anger or you didn't want to deal with your grief. You were pushing it away or you were rationalizing it or you were saying, well, if this didn't happen, I wouldn't be feeling this way, or I'm feeling this way because of that. Or, you know, you're embroiling your emotions in a whole story, right, that somehow rationalizes or somehow, you know, kind of obviates the emotional pain that you're actually experiencing from that experience. This is how we hide from our traumas. We create stories around our traumas that justify them, rationalize them, but we don't really face them. So if you have the courage to go through this process of actually facing your emotional pain, your emotional suffering, it has this quality of an epiphany. It's like seeing it for the first time. And there's this remarkable process that unfolds in the sense that it's almost as if in that moment of clear seeing, past, present, and future get wrapped up into one moment of realization, one moment of epiphany. In other words, in that split second, you see exactly how you came to the point where you're having this emotion. You can see the emotion for what it is, and you can see clearly what your life path is going to be if this emotion continues to be the way it is. It's almost as if your entire life journey through this particular emotion gets revealed in one nanosecond. So it's like seeing the karmic stream revealed in this one moment of epiphany. And one example or one context in which this has happened is in situations where I've been working with people with substance abuse, where, you know, they start to see that what they're experiencing, you know, was caused by some degree of emotional pain, and how this connects with, you know, their substance abuse and how they've been, you know, hiding themselves from this basic emotional energy that they've been afraid or reluctant to face in their lives, what they've been escaping from, those traumas that they're afraid of. So there's this moment of clear seeing. It's as if, you know, you see where it came from and you see what it is and you see where it's going. And if you've had that moment, you know, of course, once that starts to happen, once you start to experience your emotion in that way, of course it triggers, you know, evaluative thought, like, wow, where did this come from? How did this occur? And what does this mean? And out of this whole, and it's kind of like an investigative follow-up, you know, so you sort of think about what happens and you kind of process it in your mind. And as that process unfolds, you know, sort of going forward from that moment of clear seeing, this is how behavioral transformation starts to occur. Because you see how that behavior pattern can lead to suffering, can lead to, you know, unskillful actions that bring harm to yourself, bring harm to others. And you start to see it really, really clearly. And once you see it that clearly, in a way, there's no way you could go back to the kind of behavioral patterns that you were involved in that created that suffering for yourself in the first place, because you can see it so clearly. So this is how liberation happens, by clear seeing. The kind of seeing that we experience when our discursive mind becomes very, very still. And we attain this state of complete mental concentration, focus, and absorption in what's arising. This is what the mindfulness is, technically speaking. It's seeing our experience with a quiet mind, a still mind, a mind that's not reacting, judging, commenting, comparing, you know, processing our experience, which is the way we normally confront our experience, through our discursive processing, you know, faculties. But a concentrated mind is a mind in which all of this has been put aside and we face the raw reality of our experience head on, one to one, with no sort of rose-tinted glasses or no barriers, just one on one, seeing it as the saying goes, seeing it as it truly is in our experience. So this is clear seeing, mindfulness, clear mindful seeing. This is what we cultivate in the meditative practice. So, on three levels, first just working with the emotions, being able to manage them so we're not controlled by them. On the second level is, experiencing these emotions as they arise and redefining our relationship to these experiences so we're not controlled by them. And then at the third level, they call it pulling it up by its roots. Because we're seeing how these emotions are rooted in our karmic experience. And so once we start to see that, it's like digging up a plant by the roots, because you can see the roots, in terms of how they go down through the traumas that was experienced in our childhood, in our lives, etc. And you see all that suffering. And once you start to see it that clearly, all of a sudden, you've redefined your relationship to that suffering. Because now you know. Now you know. And once you know, it's never going to be the same. There's a quality of, okay, I'm in control. I know what's going on now. So that's how we begin, this process of change. I think the whole point of the meditative process, first of all, is to build awareness. Awareness that this is actually going on. The problem with most of us is that this goes on out of the range of our conscious awareness. So we're controlled by it in ways that we don't even know. We're not even aware, because we're not conscious of the fact that we're in these mental states. So the mindfulness is the opening, the opening to awareness. And then what we do with the awareness through the meditative process, through, the cultivation of, samadhi, quiet mind, what we do with that in terms of our understanding and our ability to untie, what we call these karmic knots, to see where things came from, where they are, and where they're going. And through that process, sort of reach some kind of emotional healing, some kind of emotional reconciliation. This is how this process works. And basically, freeing ourselves from suffering. Because the suffering that we experience is largely because it resides in our unconscious. And this gets back to the original theme that we're talking about, that most of our emotional pain, what we experience as emotional pain, comes from traumatic experiences that reside in our unconscious mind. So it's bringing this into conscious awareness and then being able to work with it, in the ways that we spoke about. Okay, maybe we could end with a short meditation before we...